So this podcast is going to be me reading my Peru trip report. It's the most popular trip report that I've written for my website, and I think it's a great thing to add in conjunction with the first episode, which is me exploring Jordan's story, who is someone that was in Peru with us. So I'm just going to start reading the trip report. This is my experience going to Peru, doing Huachuma and Vilca, and it's one of the monumental life milestones in my life, and I wanted to record it to make it more accessible because the written word of this trip report is almost 30,000 words long. Actually, I think it's a little bit more than that. So we're just going to get into it, guys. This trip report is going to be the longest thing that I have written because this trip is the longest that I've experienced. This is part one of two. I did my best to keep it as short as possible while conveying my experience. I also did my best to structure it and write it in a way that makes the reading as easy as possible. Thank you for your curiosity and attention. I love you. Preface, ritual. The ritual experience I was invited to partake in is called the Huachuma Masada. It is a week-long ceremony recreated from an ancient Peruvian shamanic lineage called the Chavín. The magician masquerading as human who researched and manifested this ceremony for us goes by the name Don Howard Lawler. The Huachuma Masada is comprised of three quote-unquote andes, where we drank the plant medicine Huachuma, with a rest day in between each for integration and recovery. At the end of the last quote-unquote ande, we snorted another plant medicine teacher called Vilca, which is 5-MeO-DMT, the most potent psychedelic on the planet that we know of. It cannot be understated. Witnessing Don Howard manifest this ritual and use it as a psychedelic container has forever changed how I view ingesting these plants. I've been exploring altered states of consciousness for years now, and none of them have had the kind of ritual sacredness I experienced at Spirit Quest Sanctuary. In my wilder moments, I get to thinking about the alchemists and the Philosopher's Stone. The central myth of the alchemists is that if one just got the chemistry right, one could create a stone that had the ability to transmute any material into gold. Well, I think the human nervous system is the philosopher's stone. I think ritual and ceremony is the alchemist's chemistry, and it is our experience that is the material that we turn from ordinary to divine, from crude to gold, from the profane to the sacred. And my week in the jungle has sparked in me a new desire to practice this kind of alchemy, to find and create the rituals in my life that will transform the ordinary into the sacred. The teachers and the structure. So this trip report makes sense. I'm going to introduce some plants and some core ideas around the Huachuma Masada ritual that Don Howard put us through so that you know what the hell I'm talking about. First, Huachuma. Huachuma is the original name for the plant most know as San Pedro. When the Spaniards came to South America and witnessed the amazing changes in consciousness this plant could create, they named it after Saint Peter, who is the gatekeeper of heaven. Let that marinate for a moment. The active ingredient in Huachuma is mescaline. It is consumed as an oral drink. We took Huachuma every other day for 6 days, totaling in three ceremonies. It lasts between 8 and 12 hours. Number 2, Vilca. The other primary plant teacher involved in the Huachuma Masada is Vilca. Vilca literally translates as the sacred, and it was used by the ancient Amazonian tribe, the Chavín, for thousands of years as a shamanic teacher on how to die and move into the next realm of existence. The active ingredients in Vilca are 5-MeO-DMT, NN-DMT, and bufotenin. It is consumed as a nasal snuff. We did it once on the last Masada. It lasts between 50 to 80 minutes. Number 3, Masada. I'm going to be honest and let you know that my understanding of what a Masada is still feels fuzzy, and I encourage any who read this who may know more than I to reach out and help me fortify the section. As far as I understand it, the Masada is the spiritual theme of the day. We had three Masadas, the 3 days that we drank the Wachuma. The first Masada, and I'm probably going to pronounce these like a gringo, but I am a gringo, so the first Masada is called the Wachumama, which is the mother spirit of the water. The second Masada is the Sachamama, the mother spirit of the earth. And the third Masada is, I don't even know how to pronounce it, so I'm just going to say the mother spirit of the air. Number four, the Mesa. Mesa literally means table, and Don Howard Lawler has the dopest table I have ever seen. The Mesa is where we started each Masada. It is where we drank Wachuma each day, and it is where we snuffed the Vilka that obliterated my ego for 80 minutes. On it, he has ancient artifacts from other temples, the skulls of other shamans whose lineage he carries onward, and it will likely be the table his skull will rest on after he passes and his daughter carries on his legacy. The offering and the request. At the start of each Masada, as we are standing in front of the Mesa, we are asked by Don Howard to offer our life's mission to the Mesa and Wachuma, and that if we like, we may ask for something in return. This is an important part of the ritual. It is where we get to clarify our life's purpose, and it is where we get to set our intention. I love this part of the dance, and I'm going to make it a pattern I carry on in all my future uses of plant medicine. Day zero, awareness. There is a motif in shamanism that the medicine begins working on you the moment you decide that you will do it. For me, this was most apparent the day before leaving for Peru. A bunch of my beautiful friends organized a large going-away dinner for this version of my ego story. Most of them knew the reputation of Vilka for psychologically killing the individual, and they were ready to say goodbye. The dinner was amazing, and something very weird happened. While having a conversation with my friend Cliff, I recalled my most traumatic childhood memory effortlessly and knew it would be what I would confront on Vilka. My spiritual trauma. When I was 7 or 8, after having a poor version of Christianity introduced to me, I began thinking about heaven and its promises while I lay in bed at night. I got to thinking about what eternity meant, what it really was. I imagined going to a place in the clouds, where all the best people lived. There was only love and happiness, and that we lived there forever. I'd really think about what forever was, and I would cry. I cried because of what thinking about forever made me feel. It is a feeling I still can't quite wrap language around, but it's a feeling that hurts. The closest I can get to is it's a kind of divine futility. Maybe something like what a character in a Greek tragedy feels if they witness that their fate is set. The idea of forever wounded my young mind in a way I still don't quite understand. And after I'd cry for 20 or 30 minutes, I'd pray to the God that I believed sentenced me to this fate to please help me stop thinking about it so I could sleep. This happened for a few nights, a week, for a month, and then it faded into my subconscious. The insight at dinner, however, is how I never connected this fear to my adolescent atheism. It was so obvious to me now what drove my obsession with cultivating my rationality, logic, and debating skills. As a teenager, I was an atheist on fire. I read the philosophers, honed the skepticism, and sought out any who claimed they believed in God, and I would debate them. The teenage Eric thought he was a grand illuminator of truth, but what I was realizing at dinner was that I was actually an existentially wounded 7-year-old desperately seeking shelter from eternity under the hood of my growing prefrontal cortex. Something in me knew that my week in Peru was going to bring me face to abyss with eternity again, and I'd need to put down my shield of logic and stare the dragon in the eyes. One of my favorite quotes from mythology is the Lady of the Lake talking to King Arthur, where she says, "The difference between a man and a king is that a king does not look away." Then after dinner, a second serendipitous pre-Peru departure healing happened. My physical trauma. I end up getting a ride home from a woman I had just recently met at dinner because my friends wanted to continue their night. Chance had it, and Carl Jung called Chance his god, that she was a trained Gestalt therapist. And to keep this brief, she helped me uncover more core egoic beliefs that became major themes on my trip in Peru. She helped me see that since my sports injuries, I began to fear my body and I retreated into my mind. In high school, I was just good enough at basketball and just dumb enough about the state of the world to truly believe that I had a chance to play professional basketball. I dedicated my entire young life to this goal, and as a junior, I tore my rotator cuff and never fully recovered. I resisted the evidence for a few years, but slowly it dawned on my young ego that this dream was dead. It took me years to realize that since my injury, I had condemned my body. A part of me hated my body. It blamed it on some level for not being good enough. It sounds cliche to write that now, but when I was in the car that night and I heard myself say aloud, "I am afraid of my body," something significant shifted. It was like, now that I finally said it out loud, the healing process could begin. My emotional trauma. She also, that night, with surgical insight, helped me realize the major scar on my heart. She noticed that a motif in my self-talk is the will to want to perceive or see everything. I laugh out loud now thinking about the quote I just talked about earlier from the King Arthur myth. And she mentioned that may be a sign that something hurt me that I didn't see coming when I was younger. And instantly the weight of the truth of her words caused a deep exhale to leave my body. I thought about the girl that I was in love with in high school. On a summer night before our senior year, after 4 years of a relationship swaying between lovers and friends, we kissed for the first time, and it was one of the most emotionally charged moments of my life. And then she pulled away, looked me in the eyes, and spoke 4 words that destroyed my ability to connect for a long time. "I don't feel anything." In hindsight, I love and respect her honesty, but in the moment, my heart had never felt that degree of pain. As she drove me home, I couldn't speak, I couldn't feel, and I told her, for my own healing, I couldn't talk to her, and for years, I didn't forgive her. However, eventually, I did. As life put me in her shoes in other relationships, after eating mushrooms a couple of times, and as I developed a little, I understood her, and with understanding came forgiveness. But a scar remained. The truth is that I'm very hesitant with giving romantic love. I overflow with love for my friends, but when it comes to romance, I tread very carefully, and I knew this would be something Wachuma would bring up. So in one night, the medicine brought to the surface my major spiritual trauma, my major physical trauma, and my major emotional trauma, and also each of the coping mechanisms that I developed in response to those traumas. In the face of eternity, I hid behind rationality. In the wake of physical injuries, I learned to suppress my body's energy. And in the aftermath of romantic rejection, I became hyper-obsessed with being able to read people and only loving when it felt safe. The positive is that my rationality has taught me discernment. Suppressing my body has connected me to my awareness that transcends my impulses. And my ability to read people has helped me become a competent psychologist. The negative is that my rationality has made me blind to a great degree of the human experience. My suppressing the body has disconnected me from the primal masculine power that I am capable of manifesting. And my need to read people has kept me from cultivating love with others when reciprocation wasn't certain. Wachuma and Vilka, the great plant teachers I was going to visit, knew these were the classes my soul was enrolling in, and the curriculum was ready. Day 1, arrival. After a 3-hour bus ride from Austin to Houston and a 6-hour flight from Houston to Lima, sleeping overnight in Lima, then flying 90 minutes from Lima to Iquitos, and then taking a bus for 30 minutes from the airport to the river, then hopping on a boat 30 minutes down the Amazon River, we arrived at Spirit Quest Sanctuary. The major theme of this full day of traveling arose on the 6-hour flight from Houston to Lima. I had never flown on an international flight, and the one we were on had a television screen on the back of every seat. We had the ability to watch from a great selection of movies, and this presented an opportunity I've never had before. I was able to see, in real time, dozens and dozens of people select the myths they wanted to step into. I think that's what we do with movies. And it was such a beautiful metaphor for how we all live our lives. We each are like the human in the seat, peering through a very specific lens, watching a mythic slice of the world we all share. We project all of our emotions and desires through the little lens we have onto the characters and the stories we see. I chose Interstellar as my in-flight myth. It reminded me why I do the medicine work I do. It all comes down to the children that I hope to have one day. All of this work, all of this reading and writing and learning, I do it for my potential future children. And I'm grateful I got to remind myself of this as I descended upon the jungle. Day 2, Water Masada, the Day of the Mind. Today is the first Masada. This is the first time that I get to witness Don Howard in his role as shaman, and I was fucking blown away. Outside of the ceremony, Don Howard does a good job pretending to be an old man from Kentucky. He is not that. Whatever he is remembers how to be that. Who he really is comes alive the moment you step into the maloka, which is the room that has the mesa that we drink the wachuma from. When we are in the maloka, the timeless shamanic king inside of him comes out in full force, and he becomes the absolute epitome of ageless masculine grace. As a part of the ritual, he has everyone sit around the mesa. All the women are on the left, and all the men are on the right. First, he blesses the mesa with tobacco. Then the wachuma is blessed with the smoke. After this, he begins to pour the amount he feels fits each person. But before he does this, he pauses. He slowly turns to the person he is going to pour for, and he looks them in the eyes with an intensity I have never encountered in my entire life. No human has ever looked at me like this. When he looked at me, I did not sense a man looking at me. There was no man. What looked at me was a force of nature, something ancient and powerful and massive. It was as if a legion of guardian spirits and shamans sat directly behind his eyes, channeling their power through him. Even as I say this, the rationalist in me feels I'm exaggerating, yet my heart knows that I am not even close to grasping the power of this stare. He saw what he saw in me, and he poured my cup. As I walked to the front of the mesa, my entire field of vision blurred, except for the jaguar poster that hung above the table. I looked into her eyes and offered my mission statement for my life. I am trying my best to manifest the kingdom of heaven. My request. I had an elaborate plan for what I wanted to ask for, but as I stood at the foot of the mesa, it didn't feel right to ask for anything other than truth. So what I asked for was truth. It took about another hour for everyone else to get their Don Howard soul stare down and cup pour, but once we all did, he told us to get our things and to meet us at the boats. The boat ride out. Don Howard knows what he's doing. Each mesa, after drinking, he has us all get on motorboats that glide us along the Amazon River for 30 to 40 minutes while the wachuma begins to enter our consciousness. These boat rides became the place where my deepest thoughts and visions for the week occurred. The first boat ride out gave me a deep philosophical gift that I'll offer here, but may be interesting to only a few. I'm obsessed in this life with understanding the nature of the human psyche as much as I can before I die. On this first boat ride, I had an insight. The primary will of the psyche seems to be the will to adaptation. And as the stability of the organism reaches a certain point, consciousness is able to manifest. Once consciousness manifests, a second will begins to form, and it's the will to grow. My mind offered the term the will to ascension. This is the drive we all have to grow or to develop. A metaphor for this idea is that the psyche is like an anthropomorphic ship. At first, it is only concerned with having enough structural integrity to be able to float, and this explains why the infant will learn any kind of programming if it helps it adapt at all, like fearing authority or hiding behind the mother, etc. But once the psyche has a stable boat, its next will is to move towards some new point, a metaphysically higher point. As long as the structure is stable enough, the secondary will drives the organism. But if stability begins to break down, the will to ascend evaporates and the concern again is with stability or adaptation. As you can see, the first mesada was a lot of thinking. I was defending myself from the experience by analyzing and thinking about it. We arrive at the tribe. Finally, we landed. I find myself repeating, will to adaptation, will to ascension. Don Howard has brought us to an indigenous Amazonian tribe to see how they lived, to witness their traditions, and to buy arts and crafts from them. I was feeling Wachuma very clearly now. The effects are hard to describe, but I'll do my best. If you imagine your perception like a movie theater goer, that the screen is what you visually perceive, and the person watching the film is your internal judge, who comments and judges what's on the screen, I might be able to explain this. Most psychedelics noticeably alter the way the projector creates the way the movie looks, your perception. And it also can make the person watching the movie feel very giggly or very afraid. Wachuma was different. The movie projector seemed completely accurate, but it was a little brighter, a little cleaner, and a little more glittery. And the moviegoer, he felt much, much more clear, like he'd been meditating and fasting and hadn't a need in the world. Things felt clear. I felt committed to try and uphold my request at the Mesa, to witness truth. The game. At one point, I began playing with one of the tribe's children. He was maybe 6 years old, barely 3 feet tall, and adorable. He had a beautiful blue bracelet that he smiled off one of the Westerners. He would walk near me, toss the bracelet up 2 or 3 feet, catch it, and then my eyes. And then giggle. Without language needing to be shared, I knew what was happening. He was asking me to play a game. After a few more self-tosses, I lunged and snatched the bracelet inches from his hands and he erupted in laughter. I'd give the bracelet back, he would toss it again, and I'd snatch it again, and we'd both laugh, again. Soon the game transformed. We began walking away from each other slowly, and instead of both competing for the bracelet toss, we began tossing it to each other at greater and greater distances. There was something timeless about what was happening. We were two nervous systems using what we had to play, to communicate. The reason we play is deep and old. We play to hone our nervous system so that we can hunt and to fuck. That may be crude to some, but that is the core function of our meat suits, and I don't think that diminishes the visceral joy that was coming from both of us. Soon, another interesting transformation of the game occurred. A second boy saw our fun and walked next to the first boy and began competing for the bracelet tosses. This boy was a little older and a little more athletic and consistently caught the bracelet over the first boy. After 2 or 3 tosses, something interesting happened. The more athletic boy moved a couple of feet from the first boy to allow us to each toss to each other. Essentially, the three of us could cooperate. It manifested organically, and in hindsight, it blew my mind how beautiful this gesture was. There wasn't this will to compete like there would be in the United States. But then I did something that I regret. I distinctively felt the moment where I realized the boy was offering us a game where we could all share, and I distinctively remember having the choice and choosing to toss the bracelet equally between them so that they would compete. And the moment I did that, the older boy dropped back to his original position, and for the rest of the game, they competed for the bracelet. I saw with absolute clarity that within me was something that chose competition over cooperation. I still am not sure what to do with this, but I felt it needed to be shared here if I am committed to being honest. After the game, I began walking a path through the jungle back to our main gathering area where I noticed a much younger boy following me. He was maybe 3 or 4, and I felt that he had thrown something at me. I turned around and saw that the little boy had pulled some sticky plant stuff off of a tree, clumped it together, and made a ball. He saw the game I had played with the older boys and he wanted his turn. Something about this made me start crying, and I began tossing the sticky plant ball with him. At one point, he missed my toss, and this sticky plant wad stuck to his hair, and one of the most surreal moments of my trip that day occurred. I had to squat down and slowly untangle the sticky plant from his hair, and I felt a timeless and primal program click on in me. I was a monkey, grooming the hair of another monkey, as our ancestors have done for hundreds of thousands of years. It was weird, but it was a satisfying feeling to help him. And as soon as I detangled his hair, he ran off. Thank you, boys, for your lessons. Then there was the dog. This was the saddest moment of my trip that day. After my game with the children, I had returned to the tribe's version of a town square. It was a large hut that served as the central gathering area. I was sitting on a bench, just existing in the raw awareness of Wachuma, when I saw a small dog. Earlier, I had noticed how this little guy was treated. You learn a lot about a family by how the youngest human treats the animal that they have power over. This dog was not treated well. It was handled with the same care a 3-year-old carries an old rag doll that's lost its magic. Its coat was dirty, its ribs shone, and it walked at the edge of human engagement with a caution an abused animal learns. I was sitting next to a plastic bag with banana peels in it. The dog, once it sensed I didn't mean it harm, began to rummage in the bag for food. There were old banana peels, and the dog ate them with the intensity only something starving could. My mind whispered, "Will to adaptation," and I just started crying. Did this conscious creature choose this life? Did I choose mine? Is there cosmic justice? Is this entire thing of God and one with God? And is this animal's condition perfect? Is it good? I didn't know. And I didn't care. I cried for this dog's existence. I cried for my fortune and gratitude and seemingly godlike luxury. I also cried because I had tough medicine to accept. I asked for truth, and Wachuma gave me truth. It felt as if Wachuma itself began speaking in my mind. You cry for this dog, boy, but you will not save this dog. You will not care for this dog. You will not adopt this dog, and you will not heal this dog. You've claimed you are a bodhisattva, but you are not, and that is okay. You are a human who is concerned with humans. In this life, you have chosen to help heal Western culture. There wasn't condemnation or judgment in his voice. It was just truth. It was showing me and my ego that I was and am not as noble as I would like to think. As this dog lay in the dirt with slow labored breathing, attempting to digest the fiber it wished were food, I continued to cry. As a child threw dirt on the sleeping dog because it seemed dead, I continued to cry. As a child began to yell to older children to look at the dog that had not responded to his dirt throwing, I continued to cry. I had asked for truth, and truth I was given. I am here to help in this life, but I need to not exaggerate. I need to be honest. I am not a bodhisattva. I'm a human obsessed with human psychology who is trying to help the psyche of Western culture. and that's okay. It's okay to cry in the wake of the truth that you aren't all that you thought you were. Thank you, little one, for your teaching. The dance. At some indeterminate point after my spiritual class with the dog, the tribe we came to visit begun its presentation. I grew up in Wisconsin for most of my childhood, and once a year at my school, the local Native American tribe would come and show us its traditional dances and customs. I was good friends with one of the boys who would transform from schoolmate to exotic feathered drummer and dancer. I'd watch his face during the ceremonies. I didn't have the words for it then, but what I saw was the same face I'd make when my mom asked me to perform something in front of her friends while all I wanted to do was to go in my room and play Pokemon. As this tribe's chief began sharing his tribe story, I saw passion and love and a man actively overcoming his fear of speaking. But as his speech gave way to the children performing their dance, the energy in their faces reminded me of my friend back in Wisconsin. These children are in an impossible spot, one that has fucking consumed the West many years ago. They have their culture, their tradition, and their myths, but they've tasted cell phones, computers, and mainstream media's myths, and there is something in our modern luxury that is a tradition devourer. The feeling of the sacred has withered in the wake of modernity. These children are stark, shimmering symbols of Nietzsche's, quote, "God is dead, and we have killed him." Most cultures' rituals, myths, and gods have lost their visceral connection, and I saw this in these children. All of this being said, they enjoyed themselves. They danced, they sung, we all joined, and it was beautiful. Their tradition isn't completely dead. It's just trying to compete with the techno orgy the West has produced. Side note, at one point in their tribe's presentation, they began playing drums and Aubrey started dancing. What began as some fancy footwork and spinning turned into him ecstatically dancing in the center of all of us with a fervor I have never, ever witnessed. The dance was legendary, and I have no doubt that when the final period is placed on Aubrey's life story, he's going to be a legend too. I've never met someone who has chosen to take on as many burdens as he has, who gives as much as he does to as many people as he does, and who has a demon on his back as large as he chooses to carry that he's learned to tame. It was an honor to witness. Boat ride home. As the sun was setting, we started heading back to our boats. The sky was gorgeous, and as we began gliding home, I couldn't feel anything other than sheer gratitude. The weight of my existence was hitting me. I'm in the fucking Amazon rainforest. I'm in the midst of Don Howard's ancient plant medicine ceremony with some of the most incredible people I've ever met. I got to thinking, how could I possibly repay this fortune? And the answer came to me effortlessly. Your medicine is to witness, articulate, and share the human experience as honestly as you can. This felt like Wachuma talking to me, and it felt like a deep gift. My mission, my what, is to create the most effective psychological system for treating depression, and I've known this for years. But tonight I was given my Tao, my how, the way I, the ego Eric story, can best sing my song while I go for my life's mission. And it is to be as clear and as honest a communicator of the human experience as I can. That's what I think this speaking right now is. I'm Ericing. And so, between happy crying, jamming out to my Peru playlist, and appreciating the divine feminine feeling of the wet curves of the Amazon River, I smiled at knowing my why. And we docked. The evening mesa. As we were getting off the boats, Don Howard told us to meet him back in the Maloka in an hour. We snacked, showered, and giggled the whole way back to the Maloka for that evening's closing ceremony. It was jungle dark by the time we got settled, and the only light was candle. The mesa, with all of Don Howard's artifacts, looked like the center room of an ancient temple. It felt like one, too. The Wachuma was still pulsating through my veins in consciousness. I felt light, full of love, and still in possession of a clarity that was uncanny. Don Howard was back in his eternal shamanic king vibe, and he directed us to stand at the mesa, letting two fingers from each hand rest on the table and to meditate. We all took turns doing this, and the entire experience lasted about 2 hours. I had two very interesting insights I want to share while I stood at the mesa. Both felt like they were answers that came outside of myself, but the moment I received them, my rational mind began judging whether they were legitimate or not. First, I felt like I was told how many children I would have. 4. Next, I was told that my first child would be a girl and that her name would be Aryn, spelled A-R-Y-N. I don't know what to make of this. My rational mind is a fucker and he doubts these insights, but another part of me is very relaxed and calm in the background of my psyche, grinning. I suppose we'll see. As the evening commenced, we all hugged each other and headed to dinner. Day one with Wachuma, the day of the mind, was complete. First Mesada summary. This was absolutely my most heady Wachuma day. I was trying to be a writer and a philosopher and a journalist all at the same time. I truly enjoyed myself, but in the wake of what day two was going to be, I realized in hindsight that I was protecting myself from love and vulnerability by trying to think and analyze everything. If you've made it to this point, I fucking love you and I admire you. I hope this provided you value, and please feel free to reach out and share your feedback. Thank you for your eyes, minds, and hearts. Namaste.